We turn now to Philo of Alexandria. We've gone very far back in time. Philo is a contemporary of Jesus himself. He lived in Alexandria. His writings, interestingly, have been primarily preserved in the Christian tradition. It's only relatively recently, since the Reformation and onwards, that he has become of particular interest to Judaism. Shortly after his own day, with all the events that surrounded the destruction of the temple and the dispersion of the Jewish people, Philo's writings became rather unpopular, at least in Judaism, and very popular in Christianity, but unpopular in Judaism because he sought to use the language and insight of Plato and of the Greek contemplative tradition as a way of understanding and bringing life to the traditional Jewish practice of praying the scriptures, meditating on the biblical text. And so he writes exegesis, allegorical interpretation of the scriptures, especially using the image of the life of Moses, but finding meaning in even the most obscure ritual law. And the later Christian tradition found this a very beautiful and brilliant method, and indeed his description of communities of Jews who practiced these kinds of exercises seemed to the later fathers of the church, to Eusebius of Caesarea, for example, to hint at Christian monasticism. In the texts that I've given you, and they are two, I've given you selections from his book, That Every Good Man Is Free, which describes the Essenes, which are believed by most scholars to be the Dead Sea Scrolls community at Qumran in Palestine, in Judea. That's the one selection. The other is a description of a contemplative community of what can only be described as hermits, whom he calls the Therapeutae, which literally means those who are involved in the service of God, although it can also, in a more secondary way, refer to healing and transformation. But these two texts were greatly delighted in the later Christian tradition, to the extent that Philo's description of the Therapeutae was thought by Eusebius of Caesarea to be a description of a Christian monastic community. That's impossible, of course. When Philo wrote, Jesus' ministry was just beginning, and the church had certainly not evolved celibate communities at that time. But I'd like for us to read the texts describing both the Essenes, who are for Philo a primary example of the ethical life. He uses Plato's distinction between the life of virtue, the life of ethics, and the contemplative life, the life of vision. And although they're not completely distinguished, although they're not completely separate, of course, those who concentrate on one or another poles or parts of the spectrum necessarily include something of the other part of the spectrum as well. Nevertheless, for him, the Essenes are a particular example of the ethical life. They aren't all that interested in esoteric allegory, they're very interested in living a holy life. If you drop down a bit, you'll see that I've given a picture of Qumran. There's a hole in the side of a kind of a hillside, which is one of the caves where the Dead Sea Scroll documents were found, or at least some of them were found. Here Philo describes that this community of those who are pursuing virtue are not that interested in the study of logic or of physical nature, that is to say, what we would call natural science, but they are interested in ethics, and they read the law as a way of teaching them how to behave, what to do. And he says on the seventh day, on the Sabbath, they engage in an attentive listening to the reading out of the biblical text, and then there is an interpretation. He says the greater part of their study is conveyed via symbols, he says, following an ancient mode. This trains them to piety and holiness and justice. So there is a listening to the sacred text, a taking in of a symbolic interpretation that has the effect of ethical transformation. Now, of even more specific relevance to the practice of lectio is his description of the therapeutae. And as we drop down, I've given a little brief description of Alexandria, the city not far from where Philo says these celibate hermits lived. Alexandria was a very cosmopolitan center. There were representatives of all the world's known religions there. In this little map, you can see the relationship between Alexandria with the Mareotic Lake next to it, which is the lake in which there was an island on which these hermits were said to live. And just a foretaste of what will come next time, a little bit further down, you can see little squares or little crosses marking Kelia and Nitria and Scetus. Those were the later important developments in the developing Christian monastic movement, not related to Philo's writings, but more related to the nearness to the city of Alexandria. If you drop down into the text itself, notice that Philo says that these ascetics who have left their families, they spend their time, he says, outside the walls in solitary places or gardens. He uses the word eremia, which refers to literally to the desert, to the deserted place. They are doing this, they are going into these solitary places, not because they dislike society, but because they want to be close to God. And this is for the sake of a fellowship with one another. There is a kind of hermit community in this. Notice as we drop down, in each house there is a sacred chamber, and the description of this chamber is monasterion. This is the first use that we know of the use of the word monastery to describe a place where people dwell pondering the sacred text, living in a celibate solitude. And this is being written by a contemporary of Jesus who is writing from the perspective of the Jewish tradition. He goes on to say that they keep the memory of God alive, twice daily they pray, and as you drop down into the highlighted text, the whole interval between early morning and evening is devoted to what he calls their ascesis, their asceticism, or here translated their spiritual exercise, which is they read the Holy Scriptures and apply themselves to their ancestral philosophy by means of allegory. The words of the literal text are symbols of a hidden nature. They have examples of this. They have their own tradition of the sayings of the holy fathers and mothers. The rabbinical interpretations of the text are allegorical archetypes which they themselves then use to interpret the biblical text. And notice as we go down in number 29 what the effect of this is. They apply themselves not only to contemplation, to theoria, but they also compose chants and hymns to God. That is to say, the effect of lectio and contemplatio is the composing of hymns and psalms. There is a liturgical fruit of the process of lectio divina. It comes from, in a very real sense, that experience of the biblical text which liturgy teaches us, but in the private practice of lectio, we have within our hearts a kind of a crucible of relationship with God, which can then yield the savor of new poetry, new descriptions of relationship with God, which, as we will later see, can re-enter the liturgy itself. Philo goes on to describe the Sabbath practices of these therapeutae, of these hermits. They too have a Sabbath meeting, and they too are offered allegorical interpretations of the text. And then he concludes that it is through this allegorical interpretation that they behold the beauty, the extraordinary beauty, through the glass, the polished glass, almost the mirror of the words. So here we have the application to biblical text of Plato's notion of contemplation. Here we have a witness from the time of Jesus of the practice of lectio divina, which would then be bequeathed to the Christian tradition and enriched, as we've seen, in a particular way by the understanding of prayer as paresia, or freedom of speech in relationship with God.